dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to have with us a man who is following these matters closely, writing brilliantly, speaking out lucidly on them, and always a great guest for us here at Secure Freedom Radio, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, now the editor of Breitbart's publications for national security matters. Seb Gorka, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
It's wonderful to be back on the show, Frank.
Thank you. Let's start with an encounter that you had recently, a meeting with the Russian ambassador to the United States. You aren't at liberty to say much about what he said, but I thought you quite elegantly filleted him by talking about what he didn't say. Tell us what you made of his appearance and where it sort of puts us at the moment with respect to the drama playing out under our noses in Ukraine.
Right. Well, I was delighted. I was surprised and then happy to accept this invitation yesterday to a lunch with the Russian ambassador. When I got there, I was told it was all off the record. So I decided, okay, I can't speak about what he said, but let's talk about the things that he avoided. So what does this individual who served in the United Nations representing the Soviet Union in the 1980s, so we know what he really is, what this individual commented on by omission. And in the article, the first thing I point out is I would have loved to have asked him and get him on the record on how is it that the Russian troops deployed in Crimea and then eastern Ukraine are doing so without any kind of unit insignia or designation of the country for which they are the armed forces, which is in a direct contravention of the Geneva and Hague laws of war. So how is it that Russia thinks that suddenly they are permitted to breach the Geneva and Hague Convention? Secondly, this oft-used analogy that the Kremlin has been pushing, that they did nothing wrong in the Crimea because that's just what America did in Kosovo, and so we shouldn't be complaining. The problem with that analogy, which he didn't discuss, is that after NATO, not America, but NATO and America as well, deployed against the Serbian assets in Kosovo, we did not make that protectorate the 51st state of America, unlike Russia, which has swallowed Crimea. And then we have the last point, which is the Russians are very proud of the 97% approval rating in the referendum amongst the Crimeans to reattach themselves to Russia. And the only comment I had in my article is, I've spent many, many years, 15 years in a post-communist former dictatorship, any election, whether referendum or not, in which you get up in the 90s, that's usually only something you heard Saddam Hussein or Hugo Chavez be proud about. In a democracy, anything over 60 or 70% usually indicates that the election has either been rigged or the result of intimidation in the Crimea. It's probably both.
Let's broaden the lens a little bit on the role that we're currently playing at the moment, Seb Gorka, in Ukraine. We've had the commander of U.S. forces and NATO forces, General Breedlove, issue some very stern warnings about what he thinks is going on and making no bones about the fact that it is Russia that is behind all of this. And yet, to date, what we've principally done is deploy some number of helmets and the like to Ukraine, meals ready to eat, and about 150 troops in each of four countries. Is this sufficient to deal with the kind of threat that is now emerging from Putin? And talk a little bit about your thoughts on, you know, the Putin's way of war against that backdrop.
Right. Let's remind ourselves that the first thing we need to understand is what's the strategic culture of the Kremlin. This is a lieutenant colonel from the KGB. So he in his mother's milk, sucked on the art of subversion, of indirect warfare, in using means other than direct kinetic assault to realize his goals. And that's really his playbook. A fascinating report was published by the Latvian Defense Academy on Putin's way of war. And it really does emphasize what he's doing now and what he is intending to do in the next phases. And the way the Russians are approaching conflict now is to achieve your goals without necessarily having to get into armed conflict. This is what Sun Tzu called the ultimate victory, winning without fighting. Instead of annihilating your target, encourage the inner decay. De-emphasize the use of kinetic weapons in favor of cultural war. This is a fascinating approach because you could say this is exactly what Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood are doing to America, for example, internally. Don't look for direct destruction of your enemy, but influence their mind, influence their actions. As we see, our response does not understand the nature of this warfare, because this kind of war is fundamentally reactive. Putin will only stop if we make him stop.
Let me turn to another subject on which I think there's a similar kind of cluelessness. I caught a bit of your interview on Al Jazeera America the other day, an outlet that I don't frequent myself, but I'm delighted to have seen you holding up so well there. In connection with the issue of whether the disbanding of the so-called zone assessment unit of the New York Police Department was advisable or not, you made very strongly the case that it was most ill-advised. Talk a little bit about where that leaves us. For example, as part of the larger effort, it seems, to see no evil or understand at least nothing about the enemy we're confronting, even here at home.
The fact is that the political elite in New York after 9/11 made a very justifiable decision. They said the federal government has let us down. Thousands of New Yorkers have been killed because the federal intelligence agencies didn't do their job. So we're going to do it for them instead. In the last 12 years, they've built an incredible counterterrorism capability with a much strengthened intelligence division, which included this originally called demographic unit, which was used to analyze and understand the Muslim communities in and around New York, where the jihadis would hide, where they would organize, and where they would plan attacks. And with the new political elite, with the new mayor and governor in New York, it was disbanded 2 weeks ago, following the Obama administration's narrative that this is un-Islamic, this is an offense to the local communities, and it is not needed. And that they were spying on all 800,000 Muslims in New York, which is quite amusing.
And they also made the argument that there were no benefits accruing from it. So address that point as well, if you would.
Yeah, the former deputy commissioner of the NYPD has gone on record saying this unit had 14 officers in it. So number one, the idea that 14 people are surveilling 800,000 is of course absurd and fallacious. Secondly, the idea that it hasn't led to leads, there is no way to know that unless you hold a classified a clearance and you know what these organized providing to the actual investigators. And we can't know that, and clearly CARE cannot know that either. So it's basically a false argument.
There was an interesting development the other day, yesterday, in fact. A majority of Jewish organizations in something called the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations repudiated J Street. Remind us what J Street is and why this may be an important development.
Well, this is a lobbying organization, and it's a significant one. And I think it's not an accident that this has occurred recently with Secretary Kerry's statement on the potentiality for an apartheid Israeli state. And the decision, really, I think, is a historic one, because it shows finally that there is a level beneath which even a liberal voting bloc will not stoop. And as a result, I think the cohesion or the pro-administration stance of the major Jewish organizations in America is starting to crumble because they see the reality of how little respect is held inside the White House for our most important ally in the region.
Little respect is the least of it, I'm afraid, downright enmity towards it. Zip Gorka, that has to be it for today, but we'll look forward to visiting with you again soon. Thank you for all that you're doing at one of my favorite outlets, Breitbart News Network, and also, of course, at the National Defense University. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Fred Flights joins us to talk about the curious case of the White House lying about Benghazi yesterday.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors.
Dedicated to supporting the troops and their family.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families, retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to have with us once again a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, one of the people that we turn to talk about matters involving particularly intelligence, a subject on which he is expert because he's spent his life working in that field, both as a career professional at the Central Intelligence Agency at the State Department under John Bolton and also on the House Intelligence Committee under its former chairman, Pete Hoekstra. He's Fred Flights, of course, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Fred.
Good to be here, Frank.
Let's talk quickly about this latest turn of the screws, Fred, with respect to the Benghazi scandal. We now know, as a result of some splendid work by Judicial Watch, that the White House was directly involved in the person of the Deputy National Security Advisor of the President, Ben Rhodes, in cooking the books on the nature of the attack and what precipitated it on September 11th, 2012. What are your thoughts on that and the fact that we now seem to have the White House press spokesman lying about all of this?
Yeah, we heard a few weeks ago that this was over. I mean, the Senate Intelligence Committee put out a report. Dianne Feinstein said that the conspiracy of the video and the White House lying about what happened in Benghazi, that's all been put to bed. But then this week, Judicial Watch was able to get a hold of 100 emails that should have been released to Congress and wasn't, one of which is entitled Prep Call with Susan, and it is from Ben Rhodes, an assistant to the president, deputy national security advisor for strategic communications, in which they discuss how Rice will discuss on the Sunday morning talk shows that the protests are rooted in an internet video, not a broader failure of policy. There was a consolidated effort to coach her to put forward a view that misrepresented what happened to make sure it did not interfere with the president's reelection efforts.
Fred Flights is our guest. We are talking intelligence, as we do with him with great regularity. He's a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. And Fred, you were just laying out the facts of this Ben Rhodes memo. And what's up with Jay Carney saying it had something to do with a subject other than Benghazi?
Jay Carney's in an impossible situation. This is a smoking gun, Frank. This clearly shows that the White House coached Susan Rice to say something that the White House knew wasn't true. If you listen to what Jay Carney said this week, he's now trying to say that maybe there were two sets of talking points, some other set that the White House had put together. I mean, it's just appalling. But let me say, the point that I'm really very concerned about is, where is Senator Dianne Feinstein? She said that this report that the Senate Intelligence Committee put out was the best answer to what happened at Benghazi. It was bipartisan, and that we are now moved beyond this debate over the talking points that the CIA drafted. Feinstein must be thinking that she was deceived. This email from Ben Rhodes was not provided to her. This email was crucial to the timeline on what happened after the Benghazi attacks and how the White House dealt with it. It was withheld from the committee. I want to see her step up and call the White House out on this.
Well, she should, and I'm holding my breath in the hopes that she will do it, but that's probably ill-advised. Fred Flights, let me ask you about another, now former senator, John Kerry, the Secretary of State. You've written rather critically about good riddance to his so-called peace talks in the Middle East. Why do you say that, and are they really at an end?
We all want peace talks in the Middle East. We want a solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But that peace solution will take trust by both sides. And this administration has done everything possible to undermine the trust of the Israeli people for the United States as a neutral mediator. Earlier in the year, Kerry and President Obama said that if the Israelis did not cooperate with the peace process, boycotts that are taking place by various liberal organizations and academics might increase, which I thought was a threat. So did Israeli leaders. But even worse, this past Friday, Secretary Kerry said in a private meeting, he's speaking to the Trilateral Commission, and was secretly taped, that if the Israelis did not cooperate with the peace process, they would become seen as an apartheid state, which really is an appalling thing to say. Now, there was no criticism of the Palestinians. The Palestinians, this Palestinian leadership, which refuses to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, which recently made an alliance with Hamas and Islamic Jihad, where were Kerry's criticisms of that? All of his criticisms have been directed at the Israeli leadership. So it's not surprising that Prime Minister Netanyahu wants to walk away from these talks. What other choice does he have? How can he trust the United States to negotiate a neutral deal when the president and the secretary of state are saying such outrageous things.
Yeah, and this is particularly true when, as you've indicated, Fred Flights, there's so little to show for all of these talks. What has basically been the upshot of it, as best I can tell, is they've undermined Israel. She's been induced to release hundreds of dangerous terrorists. She has been made the object of even greater enmity among others around the world. And I must say, it is high time that these talks be displaced with a more sensible policy approach. Our colleague Carolyn Glick has come up with one in her new book, The Israel Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East, which I commend to all of you. Fred, let me turn to another subject. I touched on it with Seb Gorka a moment ago. J Street is an organization that, as you know, was created basically by a radical leftist with immense amounts of money, George Soros, as what I can only describe as an influence operation intended, as they generally are, to undermine the targeted community or institution, in this case, the Jewish community and its support for Israel, which, as you've indicated, I think it certainly deserves from all Americans, but particularly from Jewish ones. J Street has just now been essentially repudiated by a group called the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on the merits of that action. But more broadly, talk, if you would, as an intelligence professional about this practice of using influence operations in this fashion for really quite insidious purposes.
J Street is trying to position itself as a liberal, hip place for people who don't like the Israeli leadership, and not just Jews in this country, but people who don't like the direction of Israeli leadership to go. But it is an influence operation to come up with an alternate agenda for people concerning Israel. And it's completely oblivious to the security concerns of Israel. And I really think it is an influence operation. And I'm happy to see that there are Jewish groups that are standing up to this organization. It's not a legitimate alternate view. It is a deliberate effort to undermine very serious security concerns that have been pursued through various Israeli administrations.
And this is evidenced in part not just by taking positions hostile to the position of the duly elected government of Israel, Fred Flights. It is also a function of this entity, George Soros's creation, promoting the policies of Israel's enemies, refusing to condemn them when they engage in murderous attacks or otherwise, embrace those who conduct them. This is the thing that is so troubling. And when it is given the patina of legitimacy as a Jewish organization, and those, including other prominent Jewish organizations who voted to include J Street, notably the Anti-Defamation League and the like, to say that this is all part of a big tent is really evidence, I'm afraid, of a rot inside that community, and one that could be fatal to it. So hats off to the majority of the Conference of Presidents and to all those who stand against the predations of this influence operation, J Street. We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. But thank you so much for joining us, as always, Fred Flights, and for the great work you do at Lignet.com, the Langley Intelligence Group Network.com, and also for the Center for Security Policy. Keep up. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Bill Roggio about the state of the long war.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Israel is under assault from practically every direction. Its Islamist enemies have over 100,000 missiles covering every square inch of the country they are determined to destroy. Europeans have taken the lead in a campaign of boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning Israel. The Obama administration has gone to great lengths to isolate, undermine, and coerce our Israeli allies. And an anti-Israel front group sponsored by George Soros is working hard to fracture and weaken Jewish solidarity in the face of such threats to their state. Fortunately, this group, J Street, was repudiated yesterday in its bid to join an umbrella entity known as the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. Every true friend of Israel should similarly reject J Street's policies of appeasement and subversion of the Jewish state. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East, and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Roggio. He monitors the Long War at the Long War Journal, whose managing editor he is. He joins us each week to discuss the state of play in that very difficult struggle. He is also a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and you find his writings in all the right places, but we're most especially when he's in this place, which is talking with us. Welcome back, Bill. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Always a pleasure.
The Obama administration is making more and more evident its determination to support, and that means to train and equip, the so-called opposition in Syria that is not part of the immoderate Islamist hostile elements there. Bill, you have been following as closely as anybody the nature of the so-called opposition, and in previous conversations with you, you've not given much encouragement to the idea that there really are people that we can confidently provide such training and equipment to in what is fundamentally an Islamist-dominated enterprise. Talk about the latest, against the backdrop of these latest reports of what the Obama team is up to.
Yeah, the CIA is funneling anti-tank weapons, including TOW missiles, to rebel groups, and we're using Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Qatar to vet groups and provide these weapons to the groups. I mean, now two of those countries really should raise an alarm, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who are notorious for supporting jihadist groups over the years.
And increasingly, Turkey is as well.
Yeah, exactly. Turkey is becoming, you know, Jordan's the only partner there that I that gives me some comfort. And then we want to arm the Syrian Revolutionaries Front, whose leader said that it's not interested at all in fighting al-Qaeda and has, in fact, actually supplied weapons to al-Qaeda and will continue to do so. There's now an effort to back this group, the Southern Front, and the Southern Front, this group claims to have led all these major battles. But when you actually study who actually led these battles, overrunning bases, taking over border crossings, et cetera, in the South, it was actually done by the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic Front and other units that are all, the al-Nusra Front, of course, is al-Qaeda's official branch in Syria. The Islamic Front is penetrated by al-Qaeda and may actually be a stalking force for al-Qaeda. So the weapons are going to fall in the wrong hands.
They almost certainly are, and the training perhaps as well. Let me just ask you, Bill, about this al-Nusra Front, because this is a group that, as you say, has direct ties to al-Qaeda. Am I wrong that if not every single one, virtually every single one of these so-called rebel factions that are not already part of that front have sworn their loyalty to it?
The al-Nusra Front is indeed al-Qaeda's official branch there. Its leader is sworn bayat or oath of allegiance to al-Qaeda, and it takes direction. Some of its top leaders or top al-Qaeda leaders as well. The groups like the Islamic Front, which is a large alliance of Salafist Islamist groups, there's several brigades in there, and they're all radical groups. Now, they haven't officially pledged loyalty to the al-Nusra Front or to al-Qaeda. And then there's a whole host of other groups. While they're not officially under the al-Nusra Front's banner, what these groups often do is fight underneath the command of al-Qaeda or the al-Nusra Front. I'll use al-Qaeda from here on out just for simplicity. And they're taking direction. They're submitting to Sharia courts when areas are under control. So it's all but official, especially when areas are under control and the al-Nusra Front is in control of areas. They will partner up with the Islamic Front, set up Sharia courts, and then everyone else, these small rebel groups, which may be, you know, may not be Islamist or whatnot, they just wind up falling under the umbrella because they're just not big enough or powerful enough. It's estimated that between the Islamic Front and the al-Nusra Front and some groups that are jihadist groups that are run by outside leaders, like the large groups of them from Chechnya and from the Caucasus and whatnot, 60,000 to 70,000 fighters under there. I mean, when you look at the official estimates, or not official, but the reasonable estimates on how many rebels there are, it's somewhere in the 100,000 to 120,000. So you're looking at a movement that is dominated by Islamists.
Yeah, and likely to wind up being, ultimately, as you say, Bill Roggio, the beneficiary of such arms and other support as we provide, any subset thereof. Bill, let me turn with you, if I may, to another part of the long war that you've been following also closely and also very well at longwarjournal.com, namely the Afghan theater in this war, I call the war for the free world. We've had the election take place there. A runoff is now scheduled. The overwhelming sense is that one or the other of those winners will agree to a bilateral security agreement with the United States that will enable us to keep some presence on the ground. The administration is thrashing around about how large it should be, evidently likely to resist the recommendations of its senior military folks on the ground. First of all, Bill, what do you think is the likelihood that we will keep forces, and what will the rules of engagement be that will hopefully enable them to do some good and, or at the very least, protect themselves? And again, more broadly, is it all for naught? Is the Taliban likely to be the successor to the present arrangement?
Yeah, and last question first. I think the Taliban is indeed likely to be the victor here. They're, even if they don't take control of Kabul, they're going to take control of large areas in southern, eastern, and even some areas in northern Afghanistan as well. But the as far as the size of the presence of the U.S. forces, the administration is seriously looking at numbers at or below 5,000, which means they could probably staff one base, and any forces there are going to be primarily committed to base security. It's not enough to do anything of import to fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. They'll be in a defensive mode. So the question is if we're not going to remain in Afghanistan in order to help win the war, why are we there? Is it just to show a force? Is it just so we could funnel aid and other money to corrupt Afghan politicians? You know, what's the purpose? If you claim that we're fighting a robust counterinsurgency or counterterrorism mission, the numbers just don't match. I think it is likely that the U.S. will leave something behind. But again, I think it'll be so small that it won't really make a difference.
I have the feeling it will be mostly equipment, unfortunately, and probably large quantities of it that we might actually need elsewhere. Bill Roger, let me turn quickly to a two-part question concerning jihadists in jail. You have Abu Qatada, a man who for a long time was operating from Britain with impunity, running jihadist operations out of mosques there. Now in a Jordanian prison, evidently he's, according to your colleague Thomas Jocelyn, running jihad from that prison. And we have a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay that the administration is being encouraged to release, a fellow by the name of Ali Ahmad Mohammed al-Razihi, who they think they can safely turn over to Yemen. Talk about the likelihood that either of these are going to be anything other than continuing metastasizing problems for us.
Yeah, I think as history has shown over the last 12, 13 years, anytime you turn these prisoners over to host countries, they just really don't know what to do with them. Or they just release them, or they allow them to operate from prison pretty much unfettered. I mean, we see this in Indonesia. They put Bashir behind jail, the head of Jamia Islamia, and you know, which is basically an al-Qaeda affiliate in Southeast Asia, and he's constantly issuing statements for this, for that, you know, pushing, you know, the same thing here with Abu Qatada, who's basically al-Qaeda's emissary for Europe, and he's weighing in on the dispute between the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham. It is all indeed one big sham. Once these prisoners, they just aren't getting, they're not being detained and being isolated. Instead, they're among the general population. They're able to recruit, you know, running the foreign version of Islam. And they're still active members in the global jihad by issuing statements and edicts and fatwas. And it's an absolute mess. Our detention policy is awful.
It is a sham, and it is unfortunately going to get more of us killed, I'm afraid. Bill Roggio, thank you for what you do to cover the long war, both elsewhere and with us. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us next week. We'll be talking next with Fred Flights about the collapse of John Kerry's great Middle East peace talks. Right after this.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There's is a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by the man who takes us inside the ring each week. He is, of course, the author of a prize-winning column of that name, Bill Gertz. He is also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon, one of the country's preeminent national security correspondents and journalists, and the author of numerous best-selling books, including The Failure Factory. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Hi, good to be on the program.
You have been writing a lot lately, Bill, both on what's going on inside the ring and more broadly about Ukraine, and in particular the attitude of the administration to what the Russians are up to there. There are a number of different pieces of this we might tease out. Let's start with the latest your reporting in the Washington Free Beacon about rather surprising, actually, given the administration, response to Russian demands for further concessions on missile defenses in Europe.
Yes, the State Department has turned down, thankfully, a proposal by the Russians that would again sought legal limitations on our missile defense deployments in Europe. And this is an interesting story in that in the middle of the Ukraine crisis, the Russians are stating that aside from Ukraine, the issue of missile defense is their most important strategic issue. And they have been trying for the past 7 or 8 years to impose legal restrictions in an agreement. And the Obama administration, to its discredit, has made numerous concessions, even canceling the fourth and most important phase of their phased adaptive approach of missile defense in Europe. Now they wanted to impose limits on where we could deploy our Aegis missile defense ships around waters of Europe, and the U.S. Said no. And this was a proposal that was made in December, and a Russian defense minister was out there recently stating that, well, we made this proposal and we haven't heard from the U.S., so therefore it's no. And a State Department official told me officially just this week that they had turned down this proposal.
Do you anticipate, as a result of what you've been reporting, Bill, that this is part of the administration's response to the Ukraine conflict, that this would be seen as a very bad time to be making further concessions? Or does this really represent a sea change in their attitude towards concessions on missile defense?
That's a question that I've asked. And it seems that, first of all, they have cut off further talks with the Russians on missile defense. This is something that members of Congress, specifically House Republicans, have been pushing for a long time, stating that there's really no good reason to engage the Russians on missile defense talks, as they have only one objective, which is to restrict our defenses. And of course, the administration has been, again, in the appeasement mode for the last 7 years as part of its reset policy, trying to gain Russia's cooperation for a missile defense deal. And as part of the Ukraine sanctions, the Pentagon has cut off all military ties with the Russians. So at least that's one positive development, at least in terms of this rampant concessionary arms control approach to world affairs that has been such a main characteristic of the Obama administration.
Indeed. Bill, turning to Capitol Hill, you have in your Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times today a piece about the House Armed Services Committee, which is beginning to put together its annual defense authorization bill, objecting to Russian aircraft engaging in the use of very sophisticated sensors in their overflight flights of the United States, pursuant to a treaty that seems largely to have gone over the side, hasn't it, at least as far as the Russians are concerned?
Pretty much, yeah. This is the Obama administration has been engaged in an internal debate over whether to allow a new and advanced Russian monitoring aircraft under what's known as the Open Skies Treaty. This is one of these touchy-feely arms control things where you let each other nation spy over their territory. The Russians want to upgrade the sensors on their aircraft with radar imaging, synthetic aperture radar imaging, and other digital sensors. And the intelligence community, as well as supporters on Capitol Hill, are saying, no way. This is going to increase the possibility that the Russians will be able to obtain valuable secrets on our weapons development program. So they've been arguing against it. The State Department and its pro-arms control faction there has been pushing to allow the Russians to do this. And this has led to a verbal tug of war with the Russians. First, they denied one of our overflights, which was needed to monitor Russian troop movements off the eastern Ukrainian border. And then they allowed the flight to go forward, all the while chastising the U.S. for not certifying this new Tu-214 aircraft.
And Bill, there have also been expressions of concern from Capitol Hill about what John Kerry recently said about Israel becoming an apartheid state. This has led to calls for his resignation from, among others, Senator Ted Cruz. What's the fallout from this conversation or remark that the secretary made in what he thought were private comments to the Trilateral Commission?
Yeah, this is the fallout from an enterprising reporter from the Daily Beast getting inside the Trilateral Commission meeting where this off-the-record session with John Kerry was held, where he talked to private business leaders and revealed that U.S. intelligence had obtained sensitive communications intercepts indicating that Moscow was fomenting the unrest. It basically confirms what has had long been suspected, but Kerry went and revealed this information publicly, and some in the intelligence community are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, this is a leak of classified intelligence information. I contacted the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to ask if a leak investigation was underway, and a spokesman there said that not to his knowledge. But again, it's raised some angst about the control of classified information within the Obama administration. It's just been one disclosure after another. They seem to be going after the press, but can't seem to police their own top officials when it comes to leaking classified information.
Yeah. One of the top officials that they seem to be determined to put out to pasture, Bill Gertz, is, of course, the Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who is currently the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and a man I have considerable regard for. Do you have any information as to whether or not he's being removed in connection with disagreements on policy matters?
No information on that. The official version is that General Flynn is stepping down as a long-planned retirement. However, it does certainly raise concerns within when any senior leader within the Obama administration leaves their post, as it's clear to me that under President Obama, there has been a certain litmus test for senior officers that they must abide by certain politically correct rules and Obama administration liberal left policies. So this seems to be another casualty of the Obama administration's political correctness and the imposition of a litmus test for senior officers.
Well, that is particularly my suspicion, Bill Gertz, because as I understood it, General Flynn had another year on his tenure at the DIA and evidently has been removed, basically, by the director of national intelligence. And as you've done so much to chronicle over the years, Jim Clapper, the DNI, is nothing if not a man who executes the politically correct program of the Obama administration. So this would be a real loss, I think, to the country if a man of Mike Flynn's character and especially his understanding of the challenges that we're facing, notably from the Islamists, were to be removed. Bill, we'll be following that story closely, as I know will you, at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times and so much more. Thank you for joining us each week and for the great work you do in those various outlets. Come back to us soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.